The typical Christopher Nolan movie takes place on a very stylish Mobius strip. Time shifts this way and that. Heroes morph into anti-heroes. Nolan's movies can be challenging. You may have to watch them twice just to get them. Like the fantastic told-in-reverse whodunit Memento, or the dream-within-dream heist story Inception. And then there's his Batman movies.
You don't owe these people anymore. You've given them everything.
Not everything. Not yet.
Nolan's slick, noirish reboots are as close to cinematic art as the superhero movie gets. His latest film is Interstellar, starring Matthew McConaughey, Jessica Chastain, and Anne Hathaway. As our near-future Earth turns into a doomed dust bowl, a handful of space explorers heads off to find a new home.
This world's a treasure. It's been telling us to leave for a while now.
Your daughter's generation will be the last to survive on Earth.
Christopher Nolan, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So movies about space travel come with a big burden of the past. One thinks of 2001, the ballet of spacecraft at the beginning, the trippy passage to wherever at the end. One thinks of Star Wars, Houston, we have a problem. As you were conceiving of this film, did you think, there are certain tropes I have to avoid or embrace, or how did that work?
Well, somebody I was talking to about the film put it very politely in that they said the film is in conversation with 2001, which I took to be a polite version of ripping it off. But I think what they were saying actually was the way I had put it is I can't make Interstellar as if 2001 didn't exist. I live in a world where it exists, and it's my chief inspiration for making the film. So I really tried to simply be inspired by it and not do things and not do things because it did it and try hopefully and add something to the great
but no apes or of... Johann Strauss.
No Strauss, no apes, exactly. Not in front of the camera.
It occurred to me, I had read that 2001 was a sort of cinematic epiphany for you. You were also 7 years old when the first Star Wars came out.
Yeah.
So, and being seven and seeing Star Wars, that must have had an influence.
Oh, yeah.
In some sense, is Interstellar a kind of combination of those, this philosophical, mysterious space picture that is also completely understandable and has a clear hero and action?
Well, I think really where you wind up is saying, okay, I grew up in a golden age of Hollywood blockbusters, and you've got to look at Spielberg in there and say, look at Close Encounters, right? You've got... To some extent, you've got exactly what you're talking about. You've got a fusion between the relatable family story, a protagonist whose journey you can follow and understand, but you're getting a glimpse into what might be in the future on a momentous scale. That was very much what I was aiming for with Interstellar. And so certainly it's inspired by the first Star Wars, by my experience of seeing 2001 on the big screen when it was re-released in the wake of Star Wars success. But also very much Spielberg's work. Also, Philip Kaufman's The Right Stuff. It's a huge influence on this film, both in the themes of the film, particularly in the first act, but also in the way it was made. I screened a print of that film for the whole crew because the things that they did in that film, and it's a much more technically perfect film than people remember. It really is one of the great American movies.
Oh, I'll have to look at it again.
It's well worth looking at it again. It's really... It's really a lot better than anybody remembers. I mean, people remember it with a certain amount of affection, particularly the imagery that's been appropriated over the years by a lot more popular films. But it really is just an American classic. Uh-huh. And what they did with sort of rear projection and things like that, technically. I mean, everyone remembers 2001 as this technically perfect masterpiece, but The Right Stuff is right up there with it.
Well, and 2001 was technically extraordinary given when it was made, a decade before the Spielbergs and the George Lucases did what they did.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Kubrick did was way ahead of its time technically and inspired the whole birth of motion control, things like that, that fed into Star Wars and Close Encounters and so on.
You've suggested by talking about what you just said about Interstellar is that it is different from many of your previous films in being so grounded in human relationships and the peculiar bonds and conflicts within families. Did you begin with it, seeing it that way?
I always saw it that way. The thing that drew me to the project was this combination or contrast between a very intimate story of a father and his children and that relationship and how it's tested, and the cosmic scale of the test of that relationship, the cosmic scale providing you an opportunity for one of these films like Close Encounters, where you say, okay, there's a hypothetical development in man's evolution, in this case, man leaving the earth to live somewhere else, you know, moving, finding our place in the universe. Seeing that by looking over the shoulder of a relatable protagonist, a family, contrasting the intimacy of the relationships with the cosmic scale, that seemed really, really fascinating to me.
And were you ready to do that somehow at 40 in a way that didn't interest you at 30?
I think I was. I mean, I think being a father myself was the reason I really gravitated towards the material.
Of four children.
Of four children. And my eldest child is a daughter. And, you know, Cooper, Matthew McConaughey's character in Interstellar, the relationship with his daughter is a very important thing in the film. And, yeah, I think as I get older and as I make more films, I find that it's the emotional connection with the stories that keeps me obsessively interested in the project, you know, a couple of years after starting it. It's very important to me.
Interstellar is set in the future. We don't know when exactly, enough so that space travel through a wormhole is possible. But its vision of the future on Earth is very early 21st century. Nothing is very different.
From a design point of view, myself and my designer, Nathan Crowley, we decided early on that we didn't want to apply any futurism to the design. We didn't want the appearance of things to be guessed at in terms of how will people's trousers look in the future, how will their hairstyles be, what will a truck look like in the future. We just said, let's have the speculations of the film be on the substance of the story. A lot of films I've loved, 2001 is one of them, Blade Runner is one of them. These are films that play the parlor game of what will design look like in the future really well, and they're fascinating to watch. I felt that we didn't have the capacity for that in this film. We're asking so much of the audience in terms of absorbing a set of ideas, going on a big journey. I wanted everything to be relatable. So I wanted the farm at the beginning to be totally relatable. I wanted the spaceships to be totally relatable. I wanted them to look like contemporary NASA technology.
Uh-huh. You don't, I read, have an email address or a smartphone. You prefer shooting on location when possible rather than in a green screen. You would like to have effects in the camera rather than spend all your time on post-production. You regret, it seems, the transformation from film to digital and projection. Are you ambivalent or even more resistant to the digital revolution?
I don't regret the transition. I deny that it's even taken place. No, I live in
massive
denial.
I believe you're wrong about that.
I live in massive denial. No, I shoot on film because it's technically the best medium. And I'm not a consumer. I'm a professional. So the ideas of convenience with the size of cameras and things like that, they're not relevant to my profession. So we shoot film because it has the highest resolution of any imaging format, because it has the best color reproduction, et cetera, et cetera. So I carry on working that way until something better comes along. As far as, you know, in technological terms, I mean, you've seen Interstellar. You'll see there's a lot of technology that goes into the film. And it's not something I resist. It's something I'm actually fascinated by.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't embrace all aspects of the technological revolutions of the last few decades. In fact, for me, there's a theme in the film that really is saying, look, we've had all kinds of technological advancements over the last couple of decades that have been very much to do with what's in our pockets, what's in the corner of our living rooms, how we communicate. I think it would be interesting to see that turn outwards again now. And, you know, when I was a kid, people were looking off the planet. They were looking, okay, how can we use technology to explore our place in the universe? I think one of the themes of Interstellar is maybe we should get back to that. Wouldn't that be exciting?
Which is interestingly ambiguous, because your Matthew McConaughey character, Cooper, has a very funny scene at the beginning where he is basically condemning this ridiculous anti-technology PC fantasy that is being laid on his children. So it is simultaneously, if not pro, it's neither pro technology nor anti technology, but it can go either way.
Yeah, and that's my attitude in real life. I think technology is an incredible thing, but I don't think you can be either entirely pro technology or pro progress for progress's
sake,
or completely anti it. It's about using it in the way that's most useful, with a degree of sincerity to your original process, if you're talking about filmmaking. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of new media developments, I mean, they're pretty fascinating. I sort of came of age as a filmmaker, if you like, in the early days of DVD, where we put a lot of time and effort into that nonlinear format, the menus and so forth, trying to expand. We're always looking for ways to expand on the immersive experience of what the film can be. And one of the things we've done to promote Interstellar is this Oculus Rift model of the spaceship.
That you Oculus Rift being this new set of headgear that gives immersive virtual reality.
Exactly. So you can be in the cockpit of the spaceship and look around and move through it.
I want that.
It was tremendous fun, really tremendous fun. So now I think there are all kinds of exciting possibilities. But I'm very conservative technologically in that I like to wait until something can really be more immersive, could be better than what we've already got, and genuinely be new and fresh, and then I'll jump in with both feet.
You're kind of conservative, it seems, generally. I mean, here you are, and well-dressed in a jacket and vest. The head of Paramount talked about how I had never been to a set where everybody was dressed so nicely and speaking so civilly.
Well, yeah, I don't know how to respond to that, really, other than, you know, the job I do is not a particularly physical one, so I don't really have an excuse for wearing, you know, shorts, a T-shirt, and all the rest. So I like having pockets.
Many people don't need the excuse.
That's true.
There are no villains, really, in Interstellar. Is it tough to write a drama in which that clear antagonist doesn't exist?
I think the antagonist does exist, and I hadn't thought of it in these terms when I was writing it, but as I started to talk about the film with people who've seen it, I realized that, to me, time is the antagonist of the film, very strongly and very much. And I, as I say, this wasn't something I particularly planned while I was writing, but definitely time is the antagonist, and that allowed me to write a film without a human antagonist, but with that.
Time, well then, time is a character in practically all of your films, a major character, right? From Memento to Inception to Following to... It's a thing.
Time has been a thing in my other films. In the case of Interstellar, I finally get to address time as a story point, not a structural issue, not an idea of subjectivity versus objectivity. These kind of things are played with in the past. Really, in the case of Interstellar, you get to make literal some of these ideas about time being relative, about relativity. And it's been tremendous fun.
And you had a famous physicist as your technical advisor. Did push come to shove sometimes where you said, no, I want to do this? And he said, you're the movie maker, go ahead. This isn't true, but go ahead.
No, he never did that.
This is Kip Thorne.
Kip Thorne, a wonderful guy to work with. And he tried to offer me the possibilities of real science, which are far more mind-bending than anything you come up with as a screenwriter. And that's how time is able to be something that we really address in the story. As opposed to just as a device. There were one or two. The only one that Kip really put his foot down and said, look, you can't do that, is I had wanted to have an element of the story where a spaceship would travel fast than the speed of light. And he just said,
that's the ultimate no-go.
He was like, it took about 2 weeks of arguing about it. And finally, I got some kind of, I suppose, intuitive glimpse into the idea of relativity without really understanding it, I see that that's impossible. And he was relieved and said, yes, if you're talking about in localized regions or something. And at that point, I realized, okay, there's a rabbit hole at the bottom of every rabbit hole. It's like, I'll have to take your word for it.
Yes. In that way, whenever I read theoretical physics, it begins to seem like metaphysics to me, like a religious thing that these priests understand that I can't pretend to. Did you ever feel as though, gosh, I'm making this whole movie about this thing I don't really get?
Absolutely. But when you deal with somebody like Kip, you realize that he's very honest about the scientific method, scientific process. He's very dedicated to it, much like a priest. I mean, he has faith in the scientific method. Uh-huh. So when I would draw things from his own writing and put them in the script and say, this is what I want to concentrate on, the mystery about, you know, naked singularity, that kind of thing, he would challenge me on it and question it. I'd say, but this is something you wrote. And he would say, yes, but that doesn't mean it's right. And I have to do my calculations, and I have to look at the other papers that have been published since and see what the scientific, the latest thought really is on these issues. It's that kind of purity to the scientific method that I think elevated in our eyes. And when it's done with true sincerity, as it is by a brilliant scientist like Kip Thorne, it's a wonderful thing to watch. I mean, he wouldn't give me a yes or no to anything in the room. He would say, I don't think so, but let me go away and do some calculations and really look into it. And then he would come back and give me an answer.
Which is the wonderful nature of science, is that perpetual self-doubt.
Yeah, perpetual self-doubt and humility in the face of scientific method.
Like I would say most film directors that I've spoken to on this show, I read that you at 7 or 8 picked up a Super 8 camera and began making movies. It seems to be the portal drug. Do you remember the first storytelling movie you made other than just shooting your parents or your house?
Oh, yeah. It was in 1978, and it was very imaginatively titled Space Wars. So you get some idea of where I was coming from in the late 70s. And it was all about, you know, trying to do Star Wars on the, you know, kitchen table. And they were tremendous, tremendous fun. I showed my kids a couple of them a couple of years ago, and I was disappointed to realize how crude they were, because in my mind, I sort of remember them the way I was hoping they would turn out rather than the actual film that had run through the camera. But no, I think it was a great gift. You know, my father let me use his Super 8 camera, which at the time...
With sound, which they had by then?
No, not sound. Never did sound Super 8 with the mag strips and all that. They were difficult to edit. But yeah, just silent Super 8.
And as a kid, what did you read?
Gosh, as a young kid, a lot of Agatha Christie, things like that, like mystery novels and so forth, but usual sorts of stuff.
It all makes sense. A Star Wars ripoff and Agatha Christie. I get it.
Exactly.
You wanted to make movies, but you did not go to film school. You went to a very good British university and studied literature. How come you didn't go to a trade school?
Well, when I was originally getting as an undergraduate, I remember my dad telling me, you know, he's like, it's all very well you want to do this film thing, but, you know, get a real education first and, you know, then see where you go with it, which I thought was sensible advice. I also felt like if you want to be a storyteller, studying English literature as I did, that's probably, if you have access to that kind of education, you don't want to pass that up. And then when I was finished with that, when I graduated, then I applied to film schools and just didn't get in anywhere. So I would have happily gone to film school. Yeah, it's very competitive. It certainly was then. I'm sure it is still now.
I want to know exactly who passed on you, because it's like that the executives who passed on Star Wars. You know.
Well, yes and no. There was a sense from some of these guys that they didn't want to take people who were kind of going to do it on their own. They didn't want to take people who were going to come to their film school just to borrow the equipment. And I was pretty upfront about, I was already making films and had been making films for years. And really, my interest in film school wasn't in sitting in a classroom. I just thought, well, they have great film equipment. Can I borrow it, please?
And they wanted cultists who they shape and...
I don't know what they were looking for, but it wasn't me.
You were 28 when you made your first feature, which was called Following for Nothing, virtually, which is about a young man who stalks strangers for fun and then meets a guy who shows him how to break into houses. I want to play a clip of that.
Nothing here of any value.
I don't seem that concerned.
I don't do it for the money.
Why do you do it?
For the adrenaline. And because, like you, I'm interested in people. Hey, you can tell a lot about people from their stuff.
That is Jeremy Theobald and Alex Haw in Following. The story is not linear, really. Two different timelines are cut together, which is something that we see in your films, many of them anyway, since Memento, Inception, Interstellar, even. All of them, as you say, in some sense, they explore either the subjectivity of time, the fungibility of its direction, and all those things. Why is that? What is so interesting to you? And obviously was at the beginning.
I think part of what's going on is I'm the first of a generation who grew up with home video. And you can't overstate the burden on structural terms that was imposed by television as the ancillary market for movies. So if you look at Citizen Kane pre-television, you're seeing the most structurally adventurous film you've ever seen. But what happens is in the 50s onwards, when you start making a lot of money in these ancillary markets, on a medium that is intensely linear, because you're not sitting there focused the way you are in a movie theater. You've got a lot of distractions. You've got other people in the room. Somebody rings the doorbell or whatever. And you sort of have to be able to dip in and out of movies. That really means they've got to be pretty straightforward. You've got to be able to pick up watching in the second hour and still get some enjoyment out of it and so forth. What happens in the early 80s is you get home video. And as soon as you can own a film the way you own a music album, as soon as you can random access, and you can rewind or whatever, it changes your relationship with movie narrative. Now, I think the...
So TV temporarily made movies stupider or more straightforward?
More straightforward narratively. Not stupider, and there's some incredible work that was done in those years. But it tended to be done in a linear fashion. Uh-huh. And I think that was a huge, huge impact. The same way you couldn't make films in black and white, you know, because you had to make them in color. Not everybody even as late as, you know, I remember talking to Scorsese about this recently, not even in the 80s people wanted to shoot black and white, but you couldn't because you had to sell to television. It wasn't because people would walk out of the movie theater if the image came up black and white. It's they would change the channel when it played on TV. And so I think I'm sort of the first of a generation who you're making films that are going to be watched more than once by definition because you're going to sell them on home video, you're going to show them on cable TV. People are going to watch them in a different way. They're going to have a different relationship to that narrative. And so it's exciting to take advantage of that.
And you certainly do. That's interesting. And I'd never thought of the determining part that home video had in that. And you make films that require at least two viewings to understand a lot of people.
Well, the way I like to put it is, you know, films you don't like, you still wind up watching them four or five times.
Because you're flipping around and you see them.
Yeah, they're on TV, you're in a hotel room, they're on the pay-per-view or whatever. You're exposed to films over a long period and in different ways just because of the way we experience media now. And so if you can give a little more density to your story, I mean, I have years to make these films and you've only got, you know, 2.5 hours, 3 hours to watch it in. So I feel a burden to be putting layers in there, to be putting things that could enhance a second or a third viewing if you're interested. Obviously, the initial experience has to be paramount.
Yes.
You know, that first viewing has to be everything. Otherwise, you won't bother to take a closer look. But I think home video changes all that. I mean, Disney were the first guys to really figure this out. And they started doing an enormous amount of visual density in their films once they realized kids were, you know, getting the VHS and watching.
You mean
again,
renaissance of Disney animation in the 80s? Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And they really sort of figured it out. I've tried to do it in a narrative sense.
Memento was when you came on my radar screen and I saw it. I thought it was an amazing movie. It was a breakthrough for you. It's about a man with no long-term memory who is trying to hunt down his wife's killer. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
Are you sure you want this?
Have I told you what this man did?
Yeah.
Well, then you shouldn't have to ask.
But even if you get revenge, you're not going to remember it. You're not even going to know that it happened.
My wife deserves vengeance. Doesn't make any difference whether I know about it. Just because there are things I don't remember doesn't make my actions meaningless. The world doesn't just disappear when you close your eyes, does it? Anyway, maybe I'll take a photograph to remind myself.
That was Guy Pearce and Carrie Ann Moss in Memento, which I discovered started out as a short story by your brother, Jonathan Nolan. How did it become a movie?
Well, it was an interesting thing. We were taking a road trip together. We were driving from Chicago to Los Angeles when I first moved to Los Angeles in the late 90s, having just finished Following. And Jonah told me that he was working on a story, and he just sort of told it to me verbally. And I got very excited about it. Immediately sort of said to him, do you mind if I take that, what you've given me, just explaining it to me and write a screenplay from it while you, finish a short story? And in the end, I think I finished the entire film about the same time it took him to write the short story. And it was a very brilliant short story. It was published in Esquire and really, really fabulous. Quite different from the film, actually. But
so you're like one of these predatory producers getting to novels before they're even published.
Well, completely. I had special access because it was my brother. And he, you know, I did warn him at the time. It's like, you know, until you finish with something, keep it close. But I think he was able to take it in the direction he wanted to. And I think he was pretty happy with the direction we took it in the film. And indeed, he worked on the film with me as well and had an input into that. And really, it was interesting to explore that story concept in a subjective way. That was really the jumping off point. I said, what if you in your short story, what if me in the screenplay and eventual film, what if we try to figure out how to put the audience into this guy's head.
It's now hard for me to imagine doing it in prose, since it's so, it seems like such a cinematic set of stunts.
Well, I mean, I was sort of jesting about, you know, how long it took him to write the short story, but I think there's a reason for that. I think it was, in a way, better suited or more easily suited to the cinema. I think it took him a very long time to get the words to do that, but he did it beautifully in the end.
And did he? How was the story different from your movie?
Well, you'd have to read it. I mean, it's really it's sort of a different guy. It's sort of a different situation. The jumping off point is the same. You know, the quest
the
for
memory
revenge,
issue,
the tattoos,
revenge, yeah.
This sort of thing. But it really has its own sort of dimension to it, its own life to it. It's really pretty great.
You have a British father, an American mother. You grew up in both places, I understand, as did your brother. How has that men of both worlds background affected how you write together, how you write, how you tell stories?
Well, I'm often asked that. And
well, then scratch it.
It's a little hard for me to say it's because it's so subjective, but there is one thing that I think people do slightly forget when they ask that, which is that around the rest of the world, whether you're in England, whether you're in France, whether you're in Japan, you know, you grow up watching Hollywood movies. And so us foreigners, to put on my English hat for a second, we feel ownership of the Hollywood language the same way Americans do. And so, you know, people have asked me about Interstellar. There's a lot of American iconography to it. But it's a universal language, to the way the Western is. And so for me, I don't know to what degree growing up in England, you know, sort of influenced the way I approach the job I do. But if you look at all the great, you know, directors of the past, whether you're Hitchcock to Billy Wilder or whatever, Hollywood has always embraced people from all over the world because I think that it has prided itself on being a universal language. And I think it's one of the attractions of working in the blockbuster Hollywood realm is you get to reach an incredibly wide audience all around the world.
Memento is not the only one of your films that is so complicated that it is challenging. Yes, people can watch it again and again on video to get a clearer sense of it. But at the time, were you surprised, given how challenging it is, that this was a commercial success?
Not really. I mean, it was more a question of when you're starting out, you don't know what to be afraid of, and that gives you great courage. You just don't know how little you know. So you dive in and you go, of course I'm going to make a film that's structured backwards because that's the way you get on the guy's head. It all made perfect sense to me. And then we couldn't find distribution for the film because people said, what the hell is this backwards film? That reality starts to set in. But ultimately, I was thrilled that it worked and succeeded for an audience. But originally, when I set out to do it, I saw it as a very accessible film.
Really?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it's very, very conventional in its overriding structure. Not the chronological structure, but, for example, I didn't reorder the scenes. I always looked at the script, read the script, wrote the script from page one to page, you know, 120, whatever. And I tried to give it a very familiar, simple film noir rhythm, even though the structure itself, the chronology that you're actually witnessing is different. So the connections between story elements are familiar and conventional for that reason, to try and orient you. And I think it's the same thinking I've tried to apply to Interstellar, in that they're very simple emotional beats that try and draw you through this film. So there are more complicated things going on if you're interested to explore them. But I think what I found with my films is people who just sort of sit back and relax and try to enjoy them as a ride, they understand them much better than people who go in sort of, you know, approaching them like there's some kind of crossword puzzle to be solved.
But they sort of invite the crossword puzzle approach, don't they?
I don't know. Maybe. Maybe. But I encourage people to try and enjoy them as an entertainment first and
sure.
foremost, because I think you get more out of them that
yeah.
way. That's how I would put it, I guess.
When you pitched the rebooting Batman to Warner Brothers in 2003, you had made three successful movies you'd of various scales. You'd shown that you could handle a big budget, but you were not. Oh, Christopher Nolan. Yes, of course. Batman. you got that gig after pitching them for 90 minutes? I've never heard of a 90-minute pitch. What did you tell them?
I don't know, but it must have been good because they signed up. No, I what I told them was, look, they took a hell of a leap of faith. You know, Alan Horn, Jeff Robinoff, Greg Silverman. I mean, these guys, they absolutely took a chance on me. There's no question. But I think that what they felt from me was a very sincere desire to say, okay, I grew up watching, you know, Dick Donner's Superman, which was an incredible film, and I just loved it. This incredible A-list cast, the epic treatment for a superhero. So he's an extraordinary figure in an ordinary world. And what happened with Batman is that film never got made. What got made was Tim Burton's incredible and wonderful and idiosyncratic, you know, could only be Tim Burton, yes, take on the character that was so influential and extraordinary, but sort of sidestepped that kind of more conventional, epic, sort of, okay, let's take an ordinary world and let's put this extraordinary figure in it. And I felt like that's a little gap in movie history, addressing the origin story of that character, which really hadn't been done, hadn't even really been done in the comics specifically, just that little, that how did he become that? And so for me, it was almost a throwback to, you know, the late 70s movies and say, okay, let's take this on as a big movie thing. And I think it was very appealing to the studio. It was a different way of approaching this kind of thing that they'd seen.
The Tim Burton Batman came out when you were in university. At the time, were you watching that and saying, no, I would do it this way? Were you already figuring it out?
No, I just was blown away by it. I mean, I loved there were a lot of movies in that 80s period, whether it's Blade Runner or Brazil, Terry Gilliam's film.
That are production design.
Exactly.
Miracles,
and the city, the idea of the city, the sort of metropolis influence thing. I just thought it was incredible. And it went on. It was so influential, you know, what he did. It revolutionized everything. So, no, it was incredibly exciting. I didn't really think about getting involved in Batman until years later, where it came up at the studio that they sort of didn't know what to do with it. And suddenly I found myself going, oh, you know, I got an idea here. I know what I would do with it because I know the version of it that I never got to see.
Right. When I saw Batman Begins in 2005, I thought, as I said on this program, it was the best superhero movie I'd ever seen. And then 3 years later, the sequel, The Dark Knight, became the best superhero movie I'd ever seen, and I guess probably still is. I want to play a clip from that. This is where Batman, for the first time, is face-to-face with his nemesis, the Joker.
Those mob fools want you gone so they can get back to the way things were. But I know the truth. There's no going back. You've changed things. Forever.
Then why do you want to kill me?
I don't want to kill you. What would I do without you? Go back to ripping off mob dealers? No, no. No. No, you. You complete me.
You're garbage. You kills for money.
Don't talk like one of them. You're not. Even if you'd like to be. To them, you're just a freak. Like me. They need you right now. But when they don't.
That was Christian Bale as Batman and Heath Ledger as the Joker. Heath Ledger had just won an Oscar for Brokeback Mountain, which didn't make him an obvious choice to play the great villain of our time. Why did you cast him?
I cast him because I'd met him a couple of times over the years for different parts and nothing had really panned out. I admired his work as an actor tremendously, but it really was this thing of just sitting down and seeing in somebody's eyes that they were ready to really show the world something. He just had that hunger. He referred to it as a hunger. He would stop working until he really was hungry to do something again. He didn't like to work too much for that reason. I thought that was a very fascinating thing. Like, he really needed to express something. That was when he would go to work. And we talked a lot about who this character would be in this telling, in this scene through the prism of our Batman universe. And he just completely got it. And when you look at an actor's eyes like that, and you see that they're ready and that they're going to bring something to it that's very, very special, you don't worry about, you know, what people are going to think, what they've done before, what they haven't done before. Uh-huh. You just know it. You see it and you go with that.
And he won the Academy Award posthumously for the role. How did you and he sort of figure out the particular mannerisms together, the phlegmy kind of speech and things? Or how did that happen?
Well, there were some things we talked about, some things we worked on. We tried to use the sort of hair and makeup wardrobe tests. as a bit of a test bed. You know, we'd get a handheld camera and my DP, Wally Fischer.
And he'd do some lines, around them. Yeah.
He'd do some lines, but we weren't recording sound.
Uh-huh.
So he was very free. You know, I think that freed him up, that we weren't saying, okay, how does the Joker laugh? Okay, tell us what he does. He was just gradually showing me things that I felt that he'd been working on for many months, truthfully, because he had been sort of burying himself in preparation. But he gradually was sort of showing his parts. And then we would offer things up from a wardrobe point of view or a weapons point of view. He'd use a knife, he'd use a gun, these kind of things. And he would move with these things and start to find the sense of threat of the character. And on the makeup front, you know, we collaborated with his makeup artist. I brought in paintings of Francis Bacon and sort of said,
that's
something in these colors. Yeah, it's a sort of feeling of that.
Yeah.
And one of the things Heath wanted to do first, which is incredibly logical, of course, it completely escaped me, is to try applying the makeup himself, just to see what happens. Because obviously, the character would actually have to do that. And
yeah.
And one of the wonderful things that came out of that was he always had sort of crusty sort of makeup on his fingers and, you know, under his nails and things, which it was just a lovely touch.
That's interesting because it's people talk about, oh, we never have enough time to rehearse movies. This is a different kind of pre-rehearsal, conceptual rehearsal that you did, it sounds like.
I've found that every actor wants a different thing out of rehearsal. And I think a lot of them, and Heath was certainly like this, they like to sneak up on it. They don't want to be put on the spot and have a bunch of, you know, producers and myself and executives sitting there going, okay, what is it? give us what it is.
Yeah.
And so you'll read a scene, just him and Christian. You'll just talk about it, whatever. And then you'll hear a little bit of a voice coming through, a little bit of a laugh, you know, he's been working on. But I didn't want to put him on the spot. Watching it develop was a really exciting thing.
Michael Caine keeps showing up in your movies, Alfred the Butler in the Batman movies, a stage engineer to the warring magicians in The Prestige, now in Interstellar, the lead astrophysicist. And he always, in your films, plays a surrogate father. Why?
Well, I just, you know, Michael has successfully implanted the idea in me that he's my lucky charm, so I just have to work with him every film. He's a very shrewd actor. Truthfully, he's such a star with everything that carries with it that he's capable of doing anything. And if you can find something to challenge him with, just something he hasn't done before, to watch him take that on, it's really incredible. Obviously, there's wonderful familiarity. There's great shorthand. You have communication, all this stuff. But beyond that, it's really, really fascinating to watch that experience and that wisdom that comes to him with his age and with his presence and with his decades of experience brought to bear. It's a really, really fun thing to be a part of. And it's wonderful to watch younger actors sort of have to rise to that and be inspired by it.
You obviously like having familiar people around as you work. Your screenwriter brother, your producer and wife, Emma Thomas, your composer, Hans Zimmer, your director of photography. Do you ever think, these are great. We have this shorthand. It works well. But, like, I'd like to try something new on this front or get this person to shoot. Or,
you know, circumstance tends to do that to you anyway. So, for example, on Interstellar, you know, Wally, he's directing now. So I had to work with a new director of
cinematographer,
Hoyte van Hoytema, whose work I'd admired. I'd never worked with before. And that was terrific. So my view is you hang on to people for as long as you can because they're always going to...
The new blood's going to come in.
Always. I mean, you know, people move on and they want to do their own thing. And so things naturally come to an end or, you know, however that works. So I try and maximize the relationships with people as much as I can.
Even though you don't want me to look at your movies as crossword puzzles that I'm trying to figure out, I have noticed that in every one, I believe every one, the male lead's wife or girlfriend either is already dead or gonna die. Why is that?
No spoilers, please. Why is that? It's because I work in melodrama. You know, I love film noir. I love crime novels. I love the universality that you are granted by stepping a little further away from conventional drama. That's why I like to work in a genre. And so things like The Quest for Revenge, you know, or the haunted nature of a protagonist, these are the staples of those forms of melodrama. And I don't use melodrama in the pejorative sense.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really saying that frees me. you know, to try and take on things that actually in the real world, you know, we try and deal with real world neurosis, if you like. What I love about film noir is it exaggerates those things and makes them universal, so anyone can relate to them. And so you get, you know, the femme fatale, you know, figures like that, you know, arising very naturally. And I really enjoyed that form of storytelling. So I think that's really where it comes from.
It's interesting, as you say, you work in these melodramatic genres, but you also, it seems to me, you have a clear, rigorous sense of, I don't want to go over this line of reality to cartooniness.
No, I don't view, when I talk about melodrama, when I talk about heightened reality, I'm really talking about the narrative, the story elements. Uh-huh. As far as tone goes, I think as a filmmaker, I get the most out of trying to adopt as rigorously realistic a tone as possible. And however much you try that, you're still dealing in a theatrical medium. And so the films of today in 20 years' time, they will look heightened. You know, the artifice will be more apparent.
This will be a Baroque period?
Yeah, well, this is true of my work as anybody else's. Yeah. But the attempt is to really try and give a feeling of texture, a feeling of reality, because my feeling is the combination of heightened dramatic elements, really extreme story elements, with a believable texture, that for me provides the most exciting entertainment.
So are you, you know, space adventure, superhero movies, thrillers, that's what you want to keep doing? Or is the romantic comedy coming? I mean, is this what you're interested and comfortable doing?
I like to think that all the films I do are different from each other in some way, that they advance, you know, what I'm doing in some way. And I certainly feel Interstellar, now that I look at it, now that it's finished, it feels like a very different kind of film for me, actually. And so I try to progress in what I'm doing and challenge myself in what I'm doing. But I also have no desire to prove myself as the sort of journeyman of Hollywood, if you like. I don't feel the need to do a musical to show that I can do a musical. I really want to try and choose projects in a vacuum, not as part of the box
career
set. Exactly. Yeah. You want to be sincere in that. And the only reason I wouldn't do a romantic comedy, for example, is I don't think I'd be capable of it. I think it's far too difficult. I think they're very, very hard to do. Yeah. And comedy particularly, you know, if you look at what, you know, guys like, you know, Todd Phillips is doing, or what Matthew McConaughey did, you know, in a lot of his romantic comedies, it's pure audience response. You're very much at the mercy of that test process. Do people laugh? Do people not laugh? There's no hiding behind
art.
Exactly. There's no hiding.
Yeah.
And that's a very, very difficult and challenging arena to work in.
Yeah.
So I am a little more comfortable not doing that. But beyond that, I like to make myself uncomfortable. I mean, there were things in Interstellar that I had no idea how I was going to do. And that feels like the right place to be at the start of a project.
You obviously, you started out making small movies because that's what new directors do. You obviously like making movies, interesting, ambitious, intelligent, good movies that a gazillion, 50 million people want to see. If you had an idea and you thought, yeah, I really love this, but only 5 million people are going to pay to see it, so I'll pass. Would you pass?
No, I'd charge more for the tickets. No, I wouldn't. I would do anything on any size.
Really?
But, oh, yeah, absolutely. But I will say the demands, you know, story-wise, the demand on a smaller film to be something truly extraordinary that you've never seen before are huge.
Right.
Because when you don't have the bells and whistles, when you don't have the toys to play with,
toys
I very much enjoy playing with, then you really are confronted with the bare fact of the drama, and is it something that's going to absolutely obsess you for a couple of years? So to me, it would all be about story. It would all be about the characters. Is it something I'm really, really drawn to? But
it's
I like
not
to
that you insist on working with $100 million budgets or nothing less.
No, exactly. No, I would happily. I mean, the only time I've really sort of stepped backwards, I suppose, obviously, was when we did The Prestige after Batman Begins. It was a much smaller project.
A lot of bells and whistles.
But a lot of bells and whistles. It felt very big to me.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, Memento felt very big to me. And I would happily go back and do a film like that, but it would still feel big to me because the narrative feels big somehow. There's a challenge there. I'd be looking for a challenge like that.
All the films you've mentioned, not your own, but others that were influential and you've loved, make complete sense. Is there a movie you love that somebody else made that would surprise the Christopher Nolan scholars of the world?
I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, one of the films I absolutely love is Malick's Thin Red Line. And I think its influence on my films is actually pretty obvious. But sometimes people seem surprised that I love that film in particular.
I'm surprised.
There you go. But if you look at the
It's not my favorite Terrence Malick film.
I beg to differ.
Many people do.
I think
I've had this argument
truly,
many times.
Really? I think it's an extraordinary piece of work. I think it's one of the best films ever made. Hmm. And I think Zimmer did the score. It's the best score ever done for a movie ever. Huh. And the way he treats memory, the way he cuts to flashbacks in the most simple, elegant way. As soon as I saw that, when I came to make Memento, it was like, it wasn't a question of copying it. It's just, oh, that's the way you do that. That's opened up that cinematic language. I think it's absolutely brilliant. So, yeah, that's a surprise sometimes. Blade Runner is a great favorite of mine, which I suppose now that I've just done a science fiction film is maybe a little more obvious. But a lot of Nicholas Roeg films I love. Sometimes people
you have an operatic taste. I mean, it's a different way, I guess, of saying melodrama, but you like these big, epic alternate realities.
I love movies that can only be films, that can only be cinema. That's what 2001 is to me. That's what The Thin Red Line is to me. I know it's based on a novel, but to me, that experience can only be cinematic. It couldn't be a radio play. It couldn't be a stage play. It couldn't really be a novel in the form it winds up in. I love films like that, and where you find that, I think it's very precious.
Christopher Nolan, it has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Christopher Nolan's latest movie, Interstellar, is in pretty much every theater now.